Hello again, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday, the 25th of March. I don't know if you saw the article in the New York Times yesterday, but it's worth reading. It's titled, "A Boy the Bullies Love to Beat Up Repeatedly." And it is the story of Billy Wolfe, a high school sophomore from Fayetteville, Arkansas. And let me just read you the beginning of it because it's quite striking. All lank and bone, the boy stands at the corner with his younger sister waiting for the yellow bus that takes them to their respective schools. He is Billy Wolfe, high school sophomore, struggling. Moments earlier, he left the sanctuary that is his home, passing those framed photographs of himself as a carefree child back when he was five. And now he is at the bus stop wearing a baseball cap, vulnerable at 15. A car the color of a school bus pulls up with a boy who tells his brother beside him that he's going to beat up Billy Wolfe. While no one records the assault with a cell phone camera, the other walks up to the oblivious Billy and punches him hard enough to leave a fist-sized welt on his forehead. The video shows Billy staggering, dropping his book bag to fight back, lanky arms flailing, but the screams of his sister stop things cold. The aggressor heads to school to show friends the video of his Billy moment while Billy heads home again, and it's not yet 8 in the morning. The article goes on to talk about Billy's life since he was five, really, being one protracted assault, and it just went on and on and on and on, and the parents Billy, very, very concerned about this, with long, long files of interactions with police and parents of those who had bullied, and with school officials. We're going to be talking about bullying and about cyberbullying this hour of the program. Every time we have this issue on the air, you call with the most remarkable stories of being bullied yourself. I'm always moved by these discussions, and I hope that we can move into a climate where there isn't as much bullying, because it has lifelong ramifications for people. People just remember when this happened to them. We have two guests with us this hour. One is featured in a film that I believe is going to open just in a couple days. Professor Dorothy Espalage is with us, and she is professor and chair of the Department of Educational Psychology, Child Development Division at the University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign. She has done scholarship in several health-related behaviors, including bullying and youth aggression, and also disordered eating in adolescents and young adults, and psychosocial adjustment of families of children managing chronic illness. She does a lot of work with graduate students with research interests in childhood sexual abuse and dating violence, and she is quoted in this new film about bullying, which will open on March 28th, I believe. Professor Espalage, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Also joining us is Marvin Berkowitz. Professor Berkowitz is a developmental psychologist who is interested in promoting children's development toward becoming healthy, happy adults who are also effective moral agents and contributors to their societies. He is the Sanford McDonald Professor of Character Education at UMSL and directs the McDonald Leadership Academy in Character Education for School Principals. How do we get people to be good moral people, of course, is a question of this hour. His research interests are in the area of character education, moral development, and prevention of risky behaviors. And we thank you so much, Professor Berkowitz, for being with us.
That's nice to be back, Kathleen.
It's interesting, this article that I referred to at the beginning, how often, and I'm wondering if this is sort of a pattern. Let's start with you, Professor Espalage. If this kind of bullying that this young child experienced went on and on and on and on for years of his life, is that unusual?
It's not unusual. Actually, that article was forwarded to me by a number of colleagues before I could even see it. And unfortunately, when I read it, I'm at a conference in New York City, and I asked a colleague, Nan Stein, I said, "Did you see the article?" And both of us looked and said, "It's a typical kind of scenario, unfortunately. A situation in which the bullying goes on for many years, it escalates, the parents become frustrated with the system and eventually file a lawsuit." Those are the types of emails that I get from parents every other day. And so for it to make the New York Times, I was kind of reading it. I was like, well, what is different about this situation than the many of hundreds of others that I hear each year? And it's not much different.
Professor Berkowitz, is that your experience as well? This is not that unusual?
Yeah, I mean, it takes so many different forms. Sometimes it's a one-shot bullying deal. Sometimes it's chronic and goes on for years. Sometimes it's a child who just doesn't want to tell because they're so embarrassed and they don't tell their parents, so the parents don't know. Sometimes the parents do know, try to work through a system that's resistant or dysfunctional. It can manifest in lots of different ways.
Yeah. There also are new forms of bullying, which we have heard about through some national stories that have been quite tragic, and that's happening on, I guess, the widespread use of cell phones and also on the Internet. Is that right, Professor Espalache?
Well, I mean, I think there's kind of a panic around the whole use of technology and bullying, so I would caution the people that are listening. I think it is a medium in which students are and adolescents are using the cell phones and chat rooms and Facebook and MySpace to continue to kind of harass one another, but it's a very small rate. And so I think we have to recognize the early research that's been conducted is showing that the highest percentage of bullying is still happening within schools. But the consistent finding, and one that we need to pay attention to across the studies, which was published in a special issue of Journal of Adolescent Health across 7 papers, consistent finding is that those kids that are victimized within schools are becoming the perpetrators or the aggressors at home on the computer or through text messaging. They're what we call bully victims. So they've been victimized. They become aggressive themselves through when they go home at night on the computer, of taking on a false identity and then getting back at the whoever has picked on them or harassed them at school. So that's a consistent finding, but I don't necessarily want to contribute to the myth that kids are using technology to harass each other. I mean, technology still has a very positive impact with youth, and most of the aggression is still happening within the schoolhouses.
Mm-hmm.
So that's important, but media really does play up these very isolated incidents, in some cases where they're adults perpetrating very inappropriate use of technology. And, you know, there's some other examples, but certainly we're not like other countries where a lot of harassment is happening through the text messaging. Again,
mm-hmm.
this is an early area in research, too.
Right.
I mean, it surprised us.
I mean, in some ways it is, in some ways it's not. I mean, there's decades of research in social psychology that shows that aggression begets aggression.
Right.
Cooperation begets cooperation. And what will happen, I mean, nowadays it's so much easier for somebody who's disempowered to come back in kind, either with these powerful weapons that are out there now, or through the Internet, to be able to spread rumors. So there are more vehicles for the disempowered to strike back.
Who's fallen down here? Why is it that we're not learning cooperation, I guess, is what we're not learning here, to have bullying still be a substantial problem? Are parents not doing their job here, or is there a lack of character education going on in schools, moral development? It's hard for me to believe it would be
the latter. I mean, but it's all of it. There's a host of things that happen. This is really a complicated issue. One piece of this is there's this belief out there, particularly for the boys, that boys will be boys. One principal, elementary school principal I worked with recently, had an epiphany as she was working with me and said, you know, I always just thought bullying was just a natural thing that kids do. Now I understand. I can't let it happen. But, you know, this was the head of a school with elementary school kids, and thought this is just play. This is what they do, and didn't understand the psychological cost to the victims of this and the damage to the perpetrator, who's morphing into the kind of person who might do that in other ways. Part of it is that there's a tolerance level for this. Part of it is that parents don't know what's going on a lot of the time. Part of it is school officials who simply, you know, our school administrators are not trained in the capacities that they need. What they need is, they should all have counseling degrees first before they become principals. Really what they need is human relations training, counseling, mediation training. That's the bulk of what they do. And so many of them are put in situations where they've got to mediate between two sets of parents. One claims my kid does this, one claims my kid doesn't, and this. And they're at a loss. They don't know how to deal with that.
Mm-hmm. So how should we in schools be dealing with this?
Well, one of the things is schools have to take front and center as part of their mission the fact that there's just zero tolerance for bullying. This is just not permissible. But that's on the negative side. Really, we have to start from the positive side and say the school is a caring community, and that's what we're striving for. That's what we're going to become. Everybody's going to, row in the same direction. We're going to help you develop the social-emotional competencies. We're going to teach them to you. We're going to model them as adults. and we're not going to allow people to undermine that with antisocial behavior. And it's got to be a central mission of the school. I mean, we lost our way about 50 years ago in American education. American education was always about trying to socialize the next generation of citizens of a democracy. And then Sputnik went up, and we panicked and ran around and said, oh, my gosh, we all have to become engineers. Perverted our schools. I think No Child Left Behind is the second Sputnik. It's doing it all over again. And we really have to understand that schools are socializing agents, just like families and communities. And they have to take the whole child seriously.
Yeah. You've been quoted as saying, Professor Espalage, that there needs to be input from kids in anti-bullying or character education programs. What do you mean?
Yeah, and I agree with Professor Butcherwitz that, in fact, we have to focus on the positive and promoting pro-social behavior. Many of the bullying prevention programs that we have that are not working do take this negative approach, this zero tolerance. We're not going to have this versus teaching kids how it is to act, how it is to create a caring community. And so for me, I was just presenting at this education conference in New York City yesterday where I tried to get preventionists and education people and administrators to understand that a good school functions like a healthy family, that in fact you have to have certain levels of supervision and respect. And the best way to operate a healthy family and operate a school is for everyone to feel a sense of belonging, and that requires some input from the students. And so what we're trying to do is to go away from this, that we're just going to teach you how to be a good kid in bullying prevention, and focus on giving kids social-emotional kind of competencies, life skills, because bullying is not an isolated antisocial behavior. We know from research that bullies go on to bully in the workplace, to bully within relationships. They become aggressive in dating relationships. And so this is really a social problem that does not disappear when kids go from middle school to high school, that in fact that need for control and dominance and that disrespect toward other students just goes into different relationships that they have. And so we've become creative as much as we can in this country to get teachers and administrators to work one-on-one with kids to create that caring community, because kids laugh at us as adults. We come in with these curricular-based kind of bullying prevention programs. They have no interest. There's no engagement. And essentially, they don't work, because there's not an investment in creating this caring community. And so you have to, you know, any good social psychologist or behavioral person actually understands that you only really want to bring about change within a climate when you feel like you have some investment in it. Mm-hmm. And so we talk to the kids about how can we create this caring environment, because they do want one. You know, as much as we always point at kids and say, oh, you're so mean and nasty, they want a safe place to go to every day.
Professor Berkowitz, your comments?
Well, I agree. I mean, I agree fully with that one. One point I would make, and it's one of the places people forget to go in all this, is that a school community starts with the adults. And when we build caring school communities, one of the things I try to emphasize, it's really hard for educators to grab onto this one, is they have to start with building an ethical, caring community amongst all the adults. I mean, all the adults in the building. Support staff, administrators, counselors, teachers, everybody, before they could ever really roll it out for kids. Because if they can't, you know, as I tell them, if you can't be the character that you want in your kids, how dare you ask them to do it? How dare you ask kids to do something you can't even be yourselves? And that's really daunting and frightening for them. And a lot of them blanch at that and won't take it on. But it goes way beyond just, you know, how can the kids in a classroom or one-on-one deal with this. And I also, you know, completely agree with the notion of teaching them the social-emotional competencies they need. I mean, Professor Espalage is in Illinois, which is the one state so far that's got social-emotional learning standards in their academic legislation. And it's a great idea. But those concepts, you know, the skills, rather, are useless if they're not in the context of a caring community. So we need them all together.
Well, what's the role of the law enforcement community in this? When does bullying reach such a point and people are getting, you know, physically hurt as a result of this? Not that the emotional hurt isn't just as bad at times, but they need to be called in. And I'm sure they see the effects of bullying frequently. Professor Espalage?
Yeah, I mean, this is an interesting issue because we don't necessarily have law to back us up in bullying like we do in sexual harassment. I mean, sexual harassment is illegal in the schools, and bullying in most cases. We have 32 states that have some type of legislation on the books, but they're quite vague and, you know, they're not really enforceable in any way. You know, schools tend to not involve the police unless there's a severe, severe threat. Now, when I read the New York Times piece, it's assault. To call this bullying really is a disservice because that was a complete criminal offense. That was an assault, and it should be treated that way. So even to have the title of bullying, that's not the typical bullying that we see.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think when it crosses the line into assault is when, you know, parents really should just, it's a criminal charge. And so I think that it becomes, you know, an issue. But schools really, we know from administrators, a recent study that was just released at this conference, is administrators underreport a lot of the assaults that are happening in the schools, whether it's sexual assault, sexual harassment, or other forms of, you know, criminal behavior. You have 6% of administrators saying that, you know, sexual harassment happens in their school or some form of sexual bullying, when in fact students are reporting it at rates of 75%. So I think that there's a lot of just pushing under the rug and referring back to No Child Left Behind, where the focus is just really the test. There's a lot of code of silence in administrators and teachers, and then, of course, the students oftentimes are victims of bullying and other forms of harassment, and they operate in silence as far as their victimization. So it's rare. There's some schools that bring in police officers to kind of say, don't bully, and, you know, to use that typical kind of scare them straight, if you will, in bullying, but we know nothing about whether or not that has an impact.
Well, the drug area doesn't. We know that scared straight and drug prevention was pretty ineffective.
Mm-hmm.
So we could extrapolate from that, perhaps.
What about girls? We mentioned boys will be boys. Are girls equally offensive when it comes to this issue as boys?
Well, there's this, and I'll pipe in here. There's this great myth in this country that was perpetrated really by the mean girls phenomenon, that girls are catty,
right,
and that girls engage in social and relational forms of aggression, and they're not physically aggressive. And unfortunately, that has caused a lot of problems because we have a substantial amount of girls that are in some school districts and some schools that are the highest perpetrators of physical forms of aggression. And on the same time, we know that boys can actually engage in relational and social forms of aggression. So in the popular media, it's like mean girls, is left even the federal government thinking that really that most of the physical aggression is perpetrated by boys, and that continues to be substantiated by the research. However, it's a myth. And I work in many schools in this country in which the most physically aggressive students are the girls.
Hmm.
Yeah, the teachers will tell you that.
I'm not an expert on this, but I do remember some literature suggesting over the last two or three decades, there has been a narrowing of the gap between some of the male and female adolescent behaviors that were a bit divergent in terms of sexual behavior, drug use, violent aggression, things like that, criminality. That where the boys were way different from the girls, going back a quarter of a century or so, that gap's been narrowing a bit.
Mm-hmm. It's exactly right, and so we see female offending at the highest rate that we've ever seen. We have judges that are no longer just kind of, you know, they're locking girls up. The offenses are quite different. I mean, when we look at the extreme form of antisocial behavior, yes, boys are still perpetrating that. But when we're talking about bullying and social relational kind of aggression, that, you know, we no longer as scholars talk about boys do this, girls do that. There's different impact on different types of aggression. It's very complicated. We do know that sexual bullying, sexual harassment is occurring at younger ages. And so things are happening earlier. We're seeing relational and social forms of aggression in preschool. And so with our advancement of society, aggression, you know, I used to do research 15 years ago when it was just limited somewhat to a peak in middle school. And now, you know, we have Laura Hainish at Arizona State who's studying and seeing relational aggression in preschool playgroups.
Oh, my.
Yeah. So, yeah. I mean, I think, you know, as we're trying to understand how this is evolving, unfortunately, all the work that we're doing, and we're doing good work in pockets in the United States, it's a big country, and where we focus on socio-emotional competencies. I mean, this is where I continue to kind of try to get people to focus on, not necessarily bullying prevention, but socio-emotional competencies we're having an impact.
Mm-hmm.
So the program that is starting to work in this country, Second Step and Steps to Respect, really focuses on giving kids these skills, the social-emotional skills.
Let's welcome phone calls, and we'll take them in a moment. We're talking about bullying this hour of the program. Our guests are Professor Dorothy Espalage. She's a professor and chair of the Department of Educational Psychology, Child Development Division at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. Dr. Marvin Berkowitz is also our guest. He taught for many years at Marquette University. He's now at the University of Missouri at St. Louis. He's a developmental psychologist interested in promoting children's development toward becoming healthy, happy adults who are also effective moral agents and contributors to their societies. 800-486-8655 or in Milwaukee, 414-227-2050. You can also send an email if you'd like to do that. That address is talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to our guests now, or to our phone calls for our guests now, and start with Boyd from Milwaukee. Hi, Boyd.
Good morning, Kathleen, and a really good show. You know, I've done a little bit of work in just substitute teaching in high schools. But my question I want to have was, I was hearing a gentleman a couple weeks ago on Joy Cardine's show. His name was Lee Siegel. And I know, Kathleen, you brought up about law enforcement, but he was talking about, you know, you mentioned the internet, the cell phones, and how a lot of people, if they want to get back at someone, or even if they don't, will use those tools. He actually came out, and I don't know if I would agree with all his arguments, but he did call for maybe, I want to say, some type of regulation. And one of the things he brought up was, and I would envision girls doing this more than boys, is where you go into college and they have these, like these chat rooms. And someone can go in there anonymously and just spread this horrendous rumor about someone that they may not like for whatever reason, and it can just devastate the person's college career, that they might just end up switching schools. Do you think that with the way things are changing that there might be some type of regulation, and if so, how would you enforce that?
Okay, whoever wants to start, go right ahead.
We're back to the internet, and the internet is a really tough one. But you know, I really agree with the point that Professor Espalage made before, that we don't want to separate that completely. I mean, rumor mongering is rumor mongering. There's a technological difference in being able to do it on the internet. One point is that once something's out there, it's out there eternally. You put a picture or a note or something on the internet, and you can't retract it. Or at least not very easily. And secondly, you can get such a big audience so fast. But it's still spreading rumors. And I don't think we need to, in any sense, treat it differently than we would lying, slandering, and spreading rumors in any other context.
Mm-hmm. Professor Espalage, your comments.
The federal government starting to think about freedom of speech, and, you know, we do want to protect our rights. So we have to be very careful of how we think about this, because it is. I mean, it's, you know, anybody can spread a rumor, and we do enjoy our, you know, our civil rights. And so it's, but we're starting to think about it. At which point do you cross the line where it would become, you know, have an impact on your future, your academic and social functioning? Certainly that's of interest. But these are conversations that are just starting to happen, because it just kind of came out of, here we have technology that is completely, you know, developed in such a fast way. We need to focus, I believe, at a young age on educating children, their parents, about technology and consumer education, and getting them to understand that very simple notion that whatever you post, it is on there forever. This isn't like a, you know, putting something on a bathroom wall that can just be painted over. So I think that it starts with education, and but building in these communities a sense of caring so that we can limit the extent to which someone would engage in this type of behavior.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Boyd, so much for your call. David, oh, I'm sorry, David, I didn't, if I got rid of you, I didn't mean to do that. Please call back. 800-486-8655 is the number. We go to Jim from Wisconsin Rapids. Hi, Jim.
Hi. I just want to say, you know, obviously this has been going on for quite a while as far as bullying. When I was young, I was abnormally tall and thin for my age, and of course everybody picked on me to a point where, especially at bus stops, it was terrorizing. People would even throw rocks at me.
Oh, my.
Yeah, so it, and luckily that helped mess up my mind and what was going on. Luckily I was able to get that straightened out later in life, but the thing that happens is even with my sons going into school, I still see that there's a lot of bullying, and I see where there's a ton of teasing, and I just see that that's completely unhealthy.
Mm-hmm.
I see that the kids are, you know, we were able to toughen up the kids and they handled it, but it's still the something we have to concentrate on in schools and in families.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess that's my comment, and my major comment is we just have to take some action. And I see a lot of talk, but unfortunately not enough action between communities and schools and things like this to enforce it.
Well, if it gives you any solace, and it won't be a lot, as one who's pretty involved in the character ed movement, it is growing nationally. It's growing slowly, but it's growing. There are 20 to 30 states now that have a character education legislation of some sort. And a lot of it, unfortunately, is unfunded, you know, legislation, but it's out there. There are national organizations. There's a lot of research out there. We've done some of that. You can go to our website at characterandcitizenship.org and look up some of the research and see what's effective, what's not effective. It is growing. There are programs like Operation Respect that Peter Yarrow of Peter, Paul, and Mary has
put together,
you know, he's always used music as a way to do social justice, civil rights, and things like that. And he found music, the song Don't Laugh at Me, to help him. And that song is exactly about this. Please don't make fun of me just because I'm different.
Mm-hmm.
Please don't hurt me, and so on. And it used some curriculum from the Resolving Conflict Creatively program, which is a good program, to help build some curriculum. It's really a door opener. It's not a full program in and of itself, but it gets the message out, opens the door for more substantive programs like Second Step that Professor Espalage mentioned, programs like the Child Development Project and Seattle Social Development Project and many others, that instead of saying let's stop bullying, they say let's develop pro-social behavior instead, which is primary prevention.
Mm-hmm. Jim made some remarkable comments in that he was tall and he was thin. I don't know if he said he wore glasses or not, but why did that make him a victim of bullying? I mean, why are there people who are natural targets of bullies, or is it just purely random, Professor Espalage?
It's not actually random, and it varies tremendously. So, you know, we think about just kind of a power differential in some way, and that power differential can be social. It could be physical, but sometimes some of the biggest kids in the schools can be the victims. So it's not random in that the perpetrators, the bullies, pick out someone that's weak, vulnerable, will tolerate the victimization, does not necessarily have friends to help them out. And so, you know, for the longest time we thought bullies were just these kind of thugs that, you know, were very socially unskilled and they just, you know, they had no kind of skill about them. But we know that there's a certain percentage of them, especially those that are the ringleaders, that are very socially skilled, may have average kind of theory of mind to be able to read their environment, pick out a target, continue to harass that target because that particular victim doesn't have the support of the peers to
mm-hmm.
take up for them. So, I mean, it varies. But we know from our research that it's not just a bully. A bully has an entourage. They have what they call reinforcers, assisters, and these are essentially some of the good kids. Many parents are listening. Could be your child that is participating in this group process. The bullies are some of the most popular kids in the school.
Hmm.
Other kids look up to them. Other kids go along to protect themselves from the victimization.
Hmm.
So, I mean, this is a very, when we talk about socialization process, peers socialize one another, and the fear of being victimized yourself if you do not have friends keeps this kind of status quo of the bullying phenomenon in many of our schools.
Mm-hmm.
And there becomes this code of silence. So kids will not discuss with adults, especially if they're not in a caring environment, or they see where adults are disrespectful to each other.
Right.
You know, and so much of this, you know, the caller talks about, he's exactly right, that in some of our schools, we're not making a dent in this because we're so focusing on the children, when in fact we haven't paid attention to the cliques and the teachers' groups, the fact that teachers, you know, are really stressed out, have high rates of depression because they have to teach to the test. They haven't been trained in the College of Educations across the country to manage their classroom. They're overwhelmed.
Right.
Kids see this, and they're very ineffective at creating this caring environment. And so kids make a decision. There's a decision tree. Like, should I go to an adult? Why would I go to an adult? They're ineffective. the victimization may get worse. So it's this whole, it's a very complicated, you know, it's just not a matter of teaching these kids these skills, but it's understanding, teaching the skills within a climate in which it's a supportive climate where they see adults that are excellent role models as far as, you know, pro-social behavior. Mm-hmm. So it's very complicated.
Very complicated. Yeah. The more we talk, the more complicated it becomes, that's for sure. Professor Berkowitz, if there is bullying going on, what is the best thing for a young person to do? Who should you go to?
Yeah, it depends on the circumstances. We said bullying happens in so many ways, shapes, or forms. Probably the best first thing to do is just to confront the bully.
Mm-hmm.
It may work, it may not work. But when it works, the whole thing's done. And I've seen that be successful, where a kid steals his or her courage and goes up to the bully and says, look, I've had enough of this.
Mm-hmm.
You know, let's have it out, or, you know, just get off my case, or what, you know, or even more reasonably, what have you got against me? What did I ever do to you?
Mm-hmm.
In each circumstance, something different is going to maybe the key that will work. It's really hard to give a – there's no special sentence I can give somebody that they can say in all circumstances. But sometimes just confronting the bully, either aggressively or cooperatively, can shut it down. Some bullies have simply never reflected on the perspective of the victim. And I've seen that happen, where the first time a kid says, this is what it's like to walk around all day long never knowing when you're going to pounce.
Hmm.
And it's an epiphany for the bully, and they just shut down. That doesn't, you know, I'm not saying that works all the time. Sometimes that works. If that doesn't work, you know, sometimes it's go to friends, parents, teachers, somebody who will have your back, help you out, counselor, but never to just hold it in.
Mm-hmm.
Never to just deal with it yourself. Got to go to somebody who can support you.
And do most people hold it in, Professor Espalaji?
They, the kids will tell us. We've interviewed thousands and thousands of kids. Or they've attempted some of the things that were just discussed, and there wasn't follow-through with the adults, or, you know, the victimization got worse. Kids, I think, are starting to speak up, but we have to recognize that there is a code of silence, especially within schools, where, you know, the adults are not attending to the bullying. There is not a zero tolerance. So it varies tremendously. It also varies tremendously in what we tell children. I mean, I'm in some inner city schools that are very, very dangerous, and confronting a ringleader of a bully group is very dangerous. So it has to be a decision that considers the contextual basis of the school, the support those children might have. So, you know, it's what we try to do when we talk to kids is to really give them a bag of tricks. And, you know, some kids can use humor in a way. Other kids, it's just completely, you know, not successful to engage in humor with the bully. Others, going to an adult and having that kind of seeking that support will be helpful. So we try to give them not this one kind of bullet that's going to do it, but lots of different types of strategies. And we call them literally a bag of tricks.
Mm-hmm. Victor from Milwaukee. Hi. Hi, Victor. Are you there?
Oh, hi. I'm sorry. Yes, I'm a mental health provider working in Brookfield, and I wanted to, I guess, at least add to the conversation and also share some personal experiences. As we're discussing, there's always a shortage of resources, and I've actually developed my own. I run a 10-week summer kids group during the off-school season. It's for children 8 to 12. And what I've done is I've combined both the bully and the teased children together.
Mm-hmm.
And so the families will participate as well. I give weekly assignments. A lot of this is just empathy training. It's something that we probably all take for granted. But I found myself being surprised often that children just are good kids, come from good homes, but really have little etiquette and human interpersonal communication. And so we talk about eye contact, physical space, shaking hands, how to expand on conversation. I give them assignments and educate the parents during the group, and then have them go home during the week and work on reflective responding and listening. Just some real simple, basic interpersonal skills. From that comes a little bit more, I guess, courage to create more conversation within their peer set. And to me, that's resolving a lot of these troubles that we're talking about. So I just wanted to at least put that out there. I don't know if I'm able to share any more specifics on how people can reach me for that group. but wanted to at least get the feedback from the professors on what they think about combining both the teased and the bully together.
Yeah. Do you have an email or a website or something? That would be best.
Sure.
Yeah.
Sure. Victor Pittman, it's all one word. It's P-I-T-T-M-A-N at AOL.com.
Okay.
I think it's a very interesting idea. Others have done that, trying to create positive peer culture and so on. One resource I suggest you may want to look at is a book called Equip, E-Q-U-I-P, by Gibbs and others that worked with adjudicated youth, aggressive youth, and they had them doing mutual support, mutual critiques, and so on. That, and there's also a book for middle schools. One of Gibbs' students, Ann DiBiase, wrote a book called Equip for Educators. Mm-hmm. Which also helps build empathy, moral reasoning skills, challenges cognitive distortions and things like that. It's a really very powerful and well-researched program.
That's good. I just wanted to add the name of the group is called The Art of Making Friends.
All right, Victor, thanks very much for your call. Professor Esbalaji, would you like to comment?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting to combine bullying victims. We say it's contraindicated in interventions within the school just because in some sense there's a re-victimization. But the way that he described it, it sounds as if this is a mutual kind of engagement where the parents have come together not because they have to come together or there's some kind of threatening suspension or expulsion. I mean, our experience is that teachers and administrators have a very difficult time working with the parents of the bullies and the parents of the victims in most cases because they kind of take a stance and it's not productive. But here it sounds like there's an agenda to promote those very skills that we've been talking about for the last 45 minutes.
Right.
And I think it's true that many of our children, I see it even in my college students at the University of Illinois, do not necessarily have basic social skills, communication skills. So I'm not sure if this is technology and, the fact that many of them are gamers or that we're busy with families, but we have very educated children that come from good families that are growing up lacking some basic social skills that they should have gotten in elementary school. So
really?
Yes. I mean, it's amazing the level of just disrespect that is emerging as these generations come together. And, it's not me that's just commenting on this. Even in the workforce, we have generations of workforces that are coming out of college where the businesses are trying to kind of figure out how it is that they're going to manage this new generation of children.
Well, I'm
going
to sound like an old curmudgeon, but what the heck. When I first started out, working in the field of child development and so on 30-some-odd years ago, I looked at all the influences on child development. And, certainly family and school were the two predominant ones, along with biology. But media was out there. But I wasn't overly concerned with the media back then. But this has changed. There are three things that have changed about the media. One is the dosage. Kids are getting more and more media impact, all because there's so many different media that they're coming from, and they're awash in this stuff. Secondly is the graphic nature of it. It's so much more blatantly antisocial. But the third piece that most people don't realize is also the ambiguity of it. When you have, characters like Dexter and Tony Soprano and so on TV, who are your heroes, who are also sadists, the ambiguity of what's normal, what's healthy, what's to be attractive is out there. And I have become concerned.
Yeah.
And I think part of what, we're talking about here, not all of it, but part of it is a product of kids who are literally marinating in an antisocial media. Oh, they're awash in it.
Mm-hmm.
And they grow up and it can't help but saturate them.
Yeah. More phone calls in a moment. Our number is 800-486-8655. Not that we haven't talked about this topic before, but our attention drawn to bullying again with the New York Times article, a striking article, A Boy the Bullies Love to Beat Up Repeatedly. And it was in the Times yesterday. We have two guests with us, Professor Marvin Berkowitz. He teaches at the University of Missouri at St. Louis. He's a developmental psychologist, and he is the Sanford McDonald Professor of Character Education at UMSL and directs the Leadership Academy in Character Education for School Principals. Also joining us is Professor Dorothy Esbalaje, and she is at the University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign. Her special areas include several health-related behaviors, including bullying and youth aggression, disordered eating in adolescents and young adults, and psychosocial adjustment of families of children managing chronic disorders. Our lines are filled. They usually are on this topic, unfortunately, and or fortunately, because we're addressing the issue. The number is 800-486-8655. Milwaukee callers 414-227-2050. Email, if you'd like to send it, is talk@wpr.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Returning to your phone calls now, and let's go to Janet from La Crescent. Hi, Janet.
Hi.
Hi.
Great show. This is very interesting. My son recently went through a bullying problem on the bus. He's in first grade, and he was getting bullied by a boy and his brother. And I knew that it was going on, but, we talked about some things to do, and it seemed like it wasn't getting too bad. It had escalated, and I hadn't known about this. And fortunately, our community is very strong, and several children on the bus were actually standing up for my son. He actually has Asperger's syndrome, and so he's kind of timid and doesn't necessarily, react the way the kids thought he would to the bullying.
Hmm.
So a lot of the kids took it upon themselves to talk to that kid and the bus driver, which didn't really resolve anything. But I did end up having to go to the school and having the teachers talk to him and his parents. It seems better now, but I just thought it was really interesting that the kids in the community came forward.
Many of the prevention programs include that what we call bystander intervention, that you try to create that climate in which the assisters and reinforcers then change their status to intervene, because sometimes, because there is a power differential, the bystander's taking a move. I mean, imagine that, although you say it did make a difference, in some ways it did. It sent a message that, they're not necessarily going to tolerate this behavior on the part of the perpetrator and the brother. And so I think it is setting a climate to say that, we're going to stick up for one another. And that is certainly part of a caring community, that you're going to have bystander intervention.
Right.
So it's a good example of that.
I want to throw in, because this is Wisconsin Public Radio, there is a move afoot in Wisconsin called the Wisconsin Character Education Partnership. I don't know the website, but if people just Google Wisconsin Character Education Partnership, there's a June conference in Waukesha every year, great conference, big one on character education. There's a move to replicate the Leadership Academy we're doing in St. Louis up in Wisconsin. There's a Wisconsin State Schools of Character program. There's a lot starting to happen. All the years that I was at Marquette for 20 years, there was nothing like this. And now there is something going on. I got to give thanks to Dick Pieper, who retired recently as the CEO of Pieper Power, as spearheading this and supporting it. But this is exactly, the way that we have to go, is to get schools to proactively say, we are not going to be the kind of place where people will stand by and watch this happen.
Right.
We are going to be proactive in helping kids understand that in a caring community, we take care of everybody, mm-hmm. Not just our friends. And it works. There's a lot of research to show that if you do this well, systematically, with research-based, scientific-based methods, that you can have those effects. One principal told me a wonderful story. It was an elementary school where a third and fifth grade brothers moved into town, and it's a little rural community. They moved in there, and one day the fifth grader burst into the principal's office, throws himself on her couch, looks at her and says, "What's wrong with the kids in this school? I don't get them."
Hmm.
And she said, "What do you mean?" He said, "They won't fight." And he came there, wanted to find out where he was in the social pecking order by fighting kids.
Hmm.
And the kids kept saying, "We don't do that here.
Hmm.
We won't fight with you." But this is a principal who worked so hard for years to create that culture in her school, systematically with a proven program and so on. So it can happen.
Mm-hmm. Well, I also want to add, I have been doing work with Wisconsin for the last 12 years. So Wisconsin is quite a progressive state. I work with Brian Knog at K-12 Associates, and we collect data in Dane County on health issues among adolescents. And so in some ways, and I've been on this show several times, so I think we need to recognize that Wisconsin is in some ways way ahead and has engaged in proactive strategies to intervene in character education and other types of creating caring communities. Mm. So I would say that again of K-12 Associates, not that Brian wants more work, but certainly he has been in Dane County and other, towns and small communities in Wisconsin and is making a difference.
Yeah, so. That's good. Thank you, Jana, for the call. Edith from Madison. Hi, Edith.
Yes, I want to share a personal experience. This is something I didn't tell the screener, but I realize this is really my personal experience. I'm 77 years old. 30 years ago, I suffered stage 2 ovarian cancer. And following surgery, I plummeted into an absolutely cataclysmic depression. And I was wise enough to know that I needed to get help. So I entered a hospital program where I was a resident there. I was allowed to be there 30 days. And when I came, I saw a young woman in the community area who was so hostile and so confrontational. Well, you'll never guess who turned out to be my roommate. It was this young woman. She was really only in her 20s. I was in my 40s. She hated the whole idea of having me for a roommate. And I came in with artwork, which I wanted to continue working on because I felt it would really help my therapy. Well, when she saw that, she became so antagonistic. And somehow or another, I had the wisdom to realize that there was something here that she wanted. So I turned the attention from myself to her. And I said, "Are you interested in art?" And she said, "Oh, yes." Well, from that moment on, I just threw myself into her, into what she wanted to do, and spoke to her, getting her to speak about what she wanted to create, what she wanted to achieve, and pursued that day in and day out, and noticed that her whole personality actually changed. She became more open. She became I don't know, lighter. She would laugh.
All right, let me get response. We're running short on time. Thanks, Edith, so much for the call. Professor Espalaji?
It's an interesting story in that it just kind of shows that, you know, we shouldn't, I mean, I take from that we shouldn't give up on these bully perpetrators, the ones that are running these groups. And, in fact, you know, it's misdirected leadership. And when I sit across from a bully, it doesn't take very long to see that there's a good kid in there, and they do kind of want to do the right thing. They just need to be directed in the right direction.
Yeah. Roger is next. Hi, Roger.
Hi. I basically wanted to say that how in the world do you deal with the biggest bulliers in the whole country? And those are right-wing politicians and ministers who have been disparaging groups in this country for years. And our kids listen to this stuff. They hear it. And it gives them permission to disparage for them to disparage people. And these are the people who are supposed to be leading in the way of creating healthy climate for our society.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd just like to hear you comment on that.
All right, Roger. Thanks for the call. Professor Berkowitz.
Well, I mean, people who... Part of what the previous caller was getting at is that people have all sorts of psychological needs. And one may end up in a bullying mode for all sorts of reasons. That one person probably felt left out, you know, disempowered, thought everybody's going to reject her, and therefore turned on others, and suddenly somebody turned to her and said, "I care about you," and that's what she needed. People manifest their needs all over the place. You know, Freud, although he got a lot of things wrong, had a wonderful idea about sublimation that, you know, he said very often surgeons are sublimated sadists and psychotherapists are sublimated voyeurs. They have these urges to do bad things to people, turn them to good. Other people have urges to do good things. They're thwarted and turn them to bad. So it's really hard to generalize as to why a politician or a minister might bully. They could do it for lots of different reasons. But certainly when one has power, it's easier to bully.
Yeah.
And, you know, and that's where you can do more damage. But the crushing influence of a single kid bullying another kid, or a teacher or an adult in a school bullying a kid, is still too much.
Mm-hmm. Tell me briefly, we have about 45 seconds left. Is this film coming out this week that you're featured in, Professor Espalaji?
Yeah, it is a DVD that we produced with a group of children in middle school. And so it's a filmmaker from Australia that actually moved to the United States to develop this DVD that is a depiction of a bullying and relational aggression, cyberbullying's in there between boys and girls. And I do not star in it. I was just kind of the expert consultant to bring this wonderful filmmaker to Illinois. It's called Stories of Us. And you can, you know, what we've done is we've developed this DVD, and then there's teachers' materials to go with it, so it'll be part of a program to, you know, it's an authentic, genuine kind of depiction of really what's happening in middle school through the voice of the eighth grade group that we worked with.
Mm-hmm. Thank you both so much for being with us. Interesting show. Our thanks to Professor Dorothy Espalage. She's a professor and chair of the Department of Educational Psychology and the Child Development Division at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. Has been working on bullying for a number of years. Also, Professor Marvin Berkowitz, he focuses on creating school and classroom climates that reduce the likelihood of such behavior. He's at the Character McDonald Leadership Academy in Character Education for School Principals, and that's at the University of Missouri at St. Louis. He was at Marquette, if the name sounds familiar, for a number of years. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing the hour. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning as well for on-air production here in our studios, and thanks for your calls and for listening, everybody. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.